Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to The River. This is Tom Fuller coming to you from beautiful Portland, Oregon, with my friends and your hosts, authors Maxine Marcellini and Jeannie St. John Taylor. Every Monday, Maxine and Jeannie get together to share what's on their hearts with listeners around the world. They chat with other authors and friends on a wide variety of topics. Some bring a laugh, some cause us to wipe away a tear, but all of them send rivers of blessing into our lives. These shows can be life-changing if our hearts are open and allow the river of God's love to pour into our deepest needs. So, listeners, are you ready? Now's the perfect time for me to stop talking and let the ladies take us on today's exciting journey down the river.
Welcome, listeners. Thank you, Tom. Aunt Maxine is not with us right now. She's going to try to make it. She is currently at the airport in San Diego, and I think I just saw her. She's at the airport in San Diego. Is that you, Maxine?
That's me. How are you doing?
Oh, you came on. It's so good. How are you doing down there? Are you getting on?
Well, I got just a few more minutes before I have to board, but I really didn't want to miss hearing Michael Hingston's voice.
No. We were so excited about it. Maxine called about 15 minutes ago, and we were just chattering about how wonderful he is before. And finally, Maxine said, well, her battery's a little low, so she better hang up. So here we are now. We're still making it. You know why I'm really excited about this show, besides the fact that I think he's a wonderful guest, Maxine?
Yes, he is. I mean, the story is fascinating, the role the dog has taken in his life. I mean, it's just is something that you won't soon forget when you read this. It captures you, but then learning what he's doing,
I know, it's great.
As a blind man, I would have
known. It's wonderful.
All these things were even possible.
Well, and speaking of blind, that is one of the reasons that I'm so excited about this, because my daughter-in-law is blind, and I'm so proud of her, I could just burst, and she is going to love this show. So let me tell you about Michael. Michael Hingston is a national ambassador for the Braille Literacy Campaign, and he's a miraculous survivor of 9/11. He now owns Michael Hingston Group, which is a consulting firm. He graduated from the University of California, Irvine, with a cum laude degree with a master's in physics. And he never let blindness stop him from achieving his goals. Michael's married, and he and his wife, Karen, live near San Francisco. For more information, you can go to michaelhingston.com, and that is on the blurb for the show. Michael, welcome.
Thank you, and I got to say hello to Maxine. I've been down to Lindbergh Field and through it many times as I used to live down there, so enjoy the airport.
Michael. I am totally fascinated by Thunderdog and your story, and you are doing fascinating stuff and being quite an ambassador for the blind. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Your book is so wonderful. We both read the whole thing, so that's how good it is. It just got us and kept us, yes. So, Maxine, you want to start asking questions, since you're probably going to hang up in the middle of the time here. Do you want to take the first turn?
Well, let's see. I really was quite fascinated even with your middle name, Michael, with that name Blizzard. I mean, you got named quite powerfully, and you have been a stormtrooper of your life, it sounds like. Would you tell us a little bit about the echolocation stuff that you did? Because that fascinated me. I had never heard that word before, and I think a lot of people don't know it, how you learn to hear what's around you.
Blizzard's a great hangman game. You know, it's a great word for that, and it is fun to have that as a middle name. Well, you know, everyone uses echolocation a little bit, and some blind people use it more than others, and sighted people could use it as well if they chose to or if they would but take the time. Basically, it's real simple. It is just that we always have noises around us, and noises change when you move closer to or further away objects, and different things sound different ways, and it's just a matter of learning how to interpret those noises. It's no different than light waves bouncing off of something and coming back to you, and your eyes send that information to your brain, and you interpret it Certainly, echolocation is not as fine as using eyesight in a lot of ways. That is to the same degree, but I get a lot of information from hearing the noises around me. And in fact, of course, it helped on 9/11 as well. But, you know, what I also have to say is none of this is magic. It seems incredible and amazing to people with eyesight because, unfortunately, our society and the world at large teaches us that sight is the only real game in town. And if you can't see, you're not perfect, you're not normal, you're not as good as anyone else. I mean, some people take it to the extreme of saying God is punishing you and clearly you're just not as good. But the fact of the matter is that not having eyesight is only a different way of looking at the world, and it's just traveling through another lane down the same road of life. And people really need to start recognizing that. You know, blind people today are in a world where the government has passed legislation, it's been around since 1938, that says we don't have to be paid minimum wage if companies want to apply for an exemption because blind people can't work competitively. That's a bunch of poppycock. You know, it's just not true.
Yeah.
But people think it's true. People think it's true because that's what we are raised to believe, that blind people can't do much. My parents were told by the doctors when I was born and it was discovered that I was blind a couple of months later, put him in a home because they'll never be able to amount to anything. That's typical. In our society today, blind parents have their children taken away and their parental rights terminated simply because they're blind, and it takes court action takes long battles to fix that. There's one that's going on right now, or the possibility of one in Washington State. 2 years ago, a blind couple had their child taken away simply because they're blind. The fact of the matter is we need to stop thinking that just because a person doesn't function as we do and utilizes the same tools that we do, we have to stop thinking that that means they're abnormal. But we haven't gotten there yet.
You know,
it's one of the, and it's one of the big problems, you know, in the previous administration in our government, they passed this set of laws called No Child Left Behind, and I will tell you, it left every disabled child. It left every child with a disability behind.
Mm.
They didn't do anything to create
any kind
of disability.
I didn't either. I didn't know that.
Yeah. They didn't do anything. But anyway.
Michael, this is Jeannie. When I first met my daughter-in-law, I knew her for 2 years. I watched her run cross-country for 2 years, and she's legally blind. I watched her run cross country for 2 years and had no idea she was blind. She was my daughter's roommate at the time. People don't know you're blind, do they? You want to talk about that and about riding your bicycle?
Well, they don't unless, you know, obviously you can look at my eyes, especially today, and tell that they're different. I was at an airport yesterday and a little child said, "What's wrong with his eyes?" And, you know, that's okay. Because it opens up a dialogue. And, of course, the parents were aghast. And I said, "Don't worry about it." You know, and we got a chance to talk and so on. But, I rode a bicycle because I learned to listen to what was going on around me, just like you learn to look at what goes on around you. Now, most drivers don't do that very well, but that's another story. but the fact is that, again, I can do that. I travel literally all over the world. Somebody does not go with me. I travel myself. I'm all grown up and know how to do that. But the problem is, again, people don't think that we can. I can't tell you the number of airplanes I've got on, and the flight attendants come back and they say, "Let me tell you about all the emergency stuff," and they do the same thing they put in their briefing, but they say, "We got to tell you this." And then they say, "Here's the kicker. When there's an emergency, you stay on the plane, and after we get the passengers off, we'll come back and get you." I was in a hotel yesterday, and I happened to be right by the door and right by the buttons. I was in, a number of other people were in, somebody was trying to get in the elevator and it was closing on them. I reached out, pushed the door open button, and opened the door, and people were amazed that I could find the open door button. It had nothing to do, of course, with the fact that there's Braille by the buttons, and, you know, I've been on that elevator a whole bunch of times. But people thought that was amazing, and that's unfortunate. Yeah, I think it's amazing that you guys get around without a cane or a dog, and, you know, I'm amazed that, Maxine, you're going to be able to walk down that jet bridge and get on that plane, and you don't have a dog or a cane to help you. So, you know, it's all relative.
A little bit, though. Let's talk about your dog, because there's a lot of dog lovers listening today, and the fact that the dog can smell 1,000 times more than we can? Hear more acutely than we can? How does this dog become your buddy to keep you safe?
Well, let's keep in mind what the dog's job is. We form a team, and we each have a part to play to make the team work. Your eyes report to your brain. Since I don't get to use those, I utilize either a dog or a cane. And they both do the same thing, but in different ways. So let's talk about the dog. The purpose of a guide dog is not to know where I want to go or how to get there. The purpose of a guide dog is to make sure that we walk safely. And the most basic level, a guide dog walks in a straight line until I tell it to turn or until it can't turn, until it can't go forward anymore, at which point it stops and it waits for me to give it a command. I don't want my dog to know where I'm going. In fact, if I feel that a dog is getting in the habit of going to the same place all the time, I'll deliberately even walk around the block or do anything to break the habit, because I don't want the dog doing that. And 9/11 was the best example of why. If I had taught my dog how to go to a particular stairwell, and if that stairwell happened to be the one that was blocked, if the dog didn't know how to go to another stairwell, and if I didn't know how to do that because I hadn't done my job right, then I wouldn't be here today. It's not the dog's job to know that stuff, but rather to make sure that we walk safe. She's the pilot, I'm the navigator. And so we learn how to do that. We learn how to form a bond, and it works really well.
Hey, while we're talking about 9/11, I was really fascinated about your job there and the way you handled it when the plane hit. Could you talk about that?
I worked as the Mid-Atlantic Region Sales Manager for a company at the time. We were on the 78th floor. We had people in that day so that we could conduct a sales seminar to teach them how to sell our products. They weren't our employees, but they were partners in sales. So when the plane hit the building, a colleague of mine who had flown in the night before, David Frank by name, David and I were in my office, and we were there finishing up some things for the seminars and getting names ready to send to the Port Authority people, and suddenly we heard a muffled explosion, and literally the building began to tip over, because they're very tall, they're made to buffet in winds and so on, they're actually big springs, and so the plane hit the building and started pushing the building. I stood in the doorway. I grew up in Southern California, and I learned a long time ago, building moves, go to door, it doesn't matter why. And so I stood in the doorway. David was holding onto my desk, and Roselle, my guide dog at the time, was asleep under the desk. By the way, if people want to see a great picture of Roselle, a very famous animal artist named Ron Burns painted her picture and sells it, and 40% of the proceeds go to a foundation that we have formed called Roselle's Dream Foundation. You can go to www.ronburns.com/ Roselle, R-O-S-E-L-L-E. And you can see a picture and buy it if you want. So anyway, Roselle was under my desk. When the building stopped moving, Roselle came out from under my desk because all this noise and junk and stuff that was going on woke her up. And so I took her leash and told her to heal. Then David looked out the window and saw fire and smoke and started to panic, and our guests began to scream. I had participated in fire drills and emergency evacuation procedures, but more important, you know, literally every day I went into that building, I thought, what am I going to do if there's an emergency? It's kind of my makeup that I think about those things. And the reason I thought that was that the World Trade Center had been bombed in 1993. So I worked to make sure I knew what to do, because I couldn't rely on reading signs on walls. And I also knew that if the building happened to be full of smoke in an emergency, people with eyesight wouldn't have been able to read signs on walls. So somebody really needed to know what's going on. And I don't mean that in an egotistical sort of way. It's just a practical way that the bottom line is, if I'm going to survive, I need to know what to do. And I can't rely on outside influences necessarily after the fact to help. I need to know and then use that information to help with whatever's going on at the time. Well, so I asked David to get our guests to stairs, which he did, and started them down. Then we went to the stairs after everyone was out of the office except for David and me. David came back. We swept the office one more time, and then we started down. Roselle was calm. But part of the reason she was calm is that I kept encouraging her and telling her she was a good girl and telling her to just do your job, good girl, keep going forward, downstairs, turn 180 degrees forward downstairs and sound calm, because I wanted her to know that no matter what I might be thinking inside, I was going to be calm and focused for her. And God was giving me the strength to do that. And I know that absolutely, as sure as we're talking on the phone, because I got the message, keep talking to Roselle. And I'm trained to do that, but I was getting it in ways that I usually don't. So I knew that I was being urged and given help to make sure that happened. So we went down the stairs. And we got out of the building and then later had to run away from Tower 2 when it collapsed. And we were about 100 yards away. And, of course, keep in mind it was a 400-yard-tall building. So it's all about teamwork. It's all about the two of us working together to get out and do the things that we need to do in order to survive.
Yeah, it's an amazing story, all the dust you had in your face and on and on and on. I could not... Oh, my goodness. It was such a long journey down all those 1,400 and some stairs and the obstacles you encountered. But I could see where you being focused was helping your dog and helping everybody around you. And oh, I wish I could see online and hear the rest of this, but I'm going to have to go and let Jeannie take over the rest of the show.
Oh, we'll miss you, Maxie.
We'll
enjoy it.
I have loved talking
with you, and I will listen to the archives later.
And we'll have to do this again when you're when you're all in the same place and talk some more. But thank you very much for having us on, Maxine.
Well, don't you go away, Michael. You're going to be going with
me. We're going to, now that you're leaving, we're going to talk about you.
Okay. All right.
Bye, Maxine.
Okay, bye-bye.
Michael, as long as we're talking about the World Trade Center when it collapsed, Tower 2 collapsed, would you kind of explain that to people? Because I think a lot of people want to know what that was really like for you. You were safely out. You were out of danger, right?
Well, I don't know that I was out of danger,
right.
Especially when Tower 2 collapsed.
Yeah.
You know, you just don't know what the building's going to do. But, you know, a lot of people say, why did the building collapse? And of course, it wasn't because the airplane hit. It was because of all the heat and the fire from the fully loaded plane from a fuel standpoint. And on all of that jet fuel, 13 tons of fuel that are 13,000 pounds of fuel that ignited literally all at once because the planes were fully loaded and caused so much infrastructure damage that that's what made the buildings fall. But people shouldn't ask why did the buildings collapse. What they should be saying is why did they stay up so long? And the reason they stayed up so long was because the architects and the builders did a great job. And then when it did start to fall, the way the building was constructed, because some floors started giving way, literally it pancaked straight down. It went straight down and didn't tip over. They did an incredible job of designing the building. For us, I think the best way to describe it is imagine you put a big spring on a table, and the spring is fastened to the tabletop, so it's fastened at the bottom. And then you start pushing at the top of the spring, so the spring is kind of bending over, and the leaves of the spring open. That's what happened to all of us on 9/11. Then after the building was able to withstand the actual collision by the airplane, it became straight up and down again. Then a few seconds later, the building dropped straight down about 6 feet because the leaves of the spring went back into their normal configuration. We didn't know any of that at the time, but that's what was actually occurring. And I think that's the best way to describe it.
You know, that kind of impresses me with the builders. And until now, until this very moment, I had thought a lot had been overlooked that the towers were able to collapse because nobody thought they would, or at least I thought nobody thought.
Well, nobody thought about that scenario. And, you know, you can only do so much.
Right.
The Empire State Building had been struck back in the mid-1940s by an airplane, strictly by accident. It was not loaded fully with fuel. So there's a big hole in the building, but the building survived, of course, and was able to be reopened. But in this case, they did a job of planning, however the bad guys did it, and they were able to make the buildings collapse. Whether they thought they were going to have as much destruction as they did is not clear, but still, they did what they did, and we survived, nevertheless. So they gave it their best shot, and you know, they're going to reap the rewards of that for a long time to come. Not only those of us or those of them who are left on Earth, but those who passed away, because I don't think there are any 72 versions up there waiting for them.
No, I don't either.
I don't believe that what they did is sanctioned by the Muslim faith and certainly anything else. That is just not the way it is. God is God, and it's the same God for all religions. And we need to remember that there are a lot of people who aren't as well off as we are and who are more easily intimidated simply because they're in an environment where they literally have guns to their heads. If you misbehave, we're going to shoot you. And unfortunately, in a lot of cases, the bad guys are a small radical minority, but they're the ones who are in control.
Yeah.
So we have to remember that and understand.
Yes, that's really true. And it's hard to think of it at a time like that when, you know, we've been attacked, but that is true. It's certainly not everybody. Hey, Michael, do you want to talk about what was going through your mind and escaping the debris when you came down? I want two things. I want down the stairwell, and I want how thirsty you were. And I want Roselle trying to take a drink and what that was like and why you didn't let her.
Well, and of course you're referring to parts of Thunderdog. And Thunderdog is not in of itself just a 9/11 book. Thunderdog is really a book about my life growing up and so on.
Yes.
And what we do is, and the way it works is that every chapter starts with one of the things that happened on 9/11, one of the episodes. We skip back to aspects of my life that perhaps helped train me for that specific thing. And then we come back to 9/11, so that by the time you read the whole book, you will read the whole story, but you'll learn a lot more about blindness and dealing with adversity and a lot of life lessons. So as we were going down the stairs,
and that's the best part of the book. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, and it's a lot of fun to write with Susie Flory. It was really great. As we went down the stairs, it wasn't hot from fire as near as I can tell all the way down. We did smell, to varying degrees, the odor of the burning jet fuel, which is how we figured out that a plane must have hit the building, although none of us knew why. A lot of people keep saying, well, of course you didn't know, you couldn't see. Excuse me, I was on the south side of the building on the 78th floor, and the plane hit on the north side of the building on about the 96th floor, and there was no way anybody could see it. Mm. But anyway, we went down the stairs, as we got further and further down, the number of bodies together kind of got greater, and the result was that we became warmer, and I think people started getting thirsty. So about the 26th floor, somebody finally passed up water bottles, and they got from vending machines, and so we were able to take drinks of water. Roselle was the thirstiest of all of us, and so we made cups out of our hands and gave Roselle water as much as we could. But when we got to the bottom, the water sprinklers were on, literally making a curtain to keep the stairwell separated from the lobby. And the reason for that is pretty clear. If there were fire that came down the stairs, because stairs are always drafty, then the people who were running it didn't want the fire to get into the lobby, so they had the sprinklers on. But likewise, if fire were in the lobby, what they wanted to make sure was it didn't get into the stairwell either. Neither happened, at least while we were going down the stairs, but the sprinklers were on, and we just worked to get through the sprinklers and out into to the lobby, which was ankle deep in water because literally the building was filling up. So Roselle wanted to take drinks of water, and I had to prevent her from doing that because I didn't know what was in the water. But she just continued to work. She worked well. She just focused and did everything that I could ask her to do. When I was looking to get a guide dog at the time of Roselle, Roselle was my fifth guide, I said to the people at Guide Dogs for the Blind that I wanted a guide dog who could focus when she needed to and who would be able to play when she was able to. They gave me exactly what I really needed right down the line. Mm-hmm. I couldn't have asked for a better guide by any definition.
And I think your book said about 50% of the dogs, is that a correct statistic, wash out because they don't focus as well as
they
should.
Like people. You know, not everyone is cut out to do any particular job.
Right.
So the success rate of being guides is about 50%. The other 50% are not bad dogs. They're not failures. They're just not cut out to be guides. They may be too easily distracted. They may have a fear reaction to some noise. They may not work at the right speed. Some of them have medical issues. There are any number of reasons, but it's not because they're bad dogs.
Oh, no.
It's just that they're not going to be guide dogs. It's like you don't necessarily strike me as the kind of person that's going to go off and be a truck driver. Maybe you could learn to do it, which is why people are better than animals in some senses. On the other hand, you're probably not going to be a pro in the NFL, you know, for a lot of reasons. It's just not the job that you're going to do. Now, you might be able to make a good ref, but, you know, that's not true.
Probably not that either. And I think you probably make a better truck driver than I would. You drove a car.
Well, I have, but there actually is a car now that a blind person has driven without any assistance. If you get a chance, go to www.blinddriverchallenge.org, and you can see a blind person literally driving a car around the Daytona Speedway, because we're creating the technology that will allow a blind person to drive a car. And before I hear all the driver jokes, let me point out that if you go to any insurance statistics, you're going to see that fewer blind drivers have accidents than sighted drivers anyway. So, but the reality is that more collision avoidance technology and other kinds of things are being developed that will allow a blind person to drive a car just like a sighted person. It's not going to happen in the near future, but it will happen.
My daughter-in-law actually just got her driver's license, even though she has Stargardt's, which, if you know what that is, she was partially blind, but she's quite blind, actually, and she is able to drive, and she drives really well. Hey, we're starting to run out of time, so I just wanted – you give an analogy between a sheep that are afraid and how we respond to the good shepherd. What did you learn from your own father's experience about tending sheep?
That it's a great time to do a lot of thinking, and that we should sit back and do more thinking in our lives, not just run from event to event and thing to thing, that it is important to take some time to slow down and smell the roses every day. It is important to ponder and to pray and to talk with God and listen just as much as talk. I think that those are all very crucial things, because my dad told me on a regular basis how when he was tending sheep and out there in the world by himself, there was nobody else tending sheep with him. It gave him a lot of time to think about life and himself and commune with God.
Mm. His name's not David, is it? That was a joke.
I'm sorry?
I said his name's not David, is it? It was a little joke.
No,
sorry.
I hate to tell you, it was George.
George, okay. Well, we are talking
Same
with
concept.
Michael Hingson about his book, Thunderdog, The True Story of a Blind Man, His Guide Dog, and the Triumph of Trust at Ground Zero. This book was on the New York Times bestseller list. He's been interviewed. Michael's been interviewed on Larry King 5 times. Is that right, Michael? 5?
Right. And the book keeps popping on and off the bestseller list, so if people will go buy it at Amazon or Barnes & Noble or any bookstore, it'll go back on the list.
Yes. And what happened to you when Osama bin Laden was killed?
We were talking about that before.
Uh-huh.
I started getting calls at like 2 in the morning after he was killed asking for interviews and my thoughts on it. And, you know, my response was, he got justice, and that was what it was all about.
Yes.
It shouldn't be vengeance, but on the other hand, when somebody does something like that, we should deal with it.
Yes.
But we shouldn't deal with it out of total anger. And by the way, we shouldn't be mad at God for what happened on 9/11, because God gave us the great gift of free will. Without that, then we wouldn't really be who we are. So rather than people railing at God, we need to be the ones to make a choice as to how we deal with a change in our lives, like 9/11 or any change in our lives. We may not be able to control the change, but we can control how we deal with the change, and that's the more important issue.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael. We have loved having you on air. Listeners, if you buy Michael's book, Thunderdog, which I'm sure you can get at any bookstore or at Amazon, at Amazon.com, you'll learn about...
Or on my website.
Or at his website. You want to give him that address?
www.michaelhingson.com. And if they go to our website and buy a book, it'll be autographed, and it'll also come with Roselle's potograph.
Oh, how cute. If you get this book, you'll learn all kinds of developments that Michael just touched on here. You'll learn all about them. You'll just be absolutely amazed. Also, you'll learn about how he bought a car when he was in college. you'll learn about the time he flew an airplane and about his wife, Karen, which we just didn't even touch on here. Do you want to say something wonderful about her here briefly?
I love her more than Roselle. You asked me that earlier.
That's what I wonder.
Karen and I have been married. Karen and I have been married almost 30 years. It will be 30 years in November, and we love each other more than ever, and we enjoy being together a lot. She is also a person who happens to have a so-called disability. She's in a wheelchair, so it's great. She reads, I push, works out really well.
Great having you here. We're so excited. Maybe we will have you on again. You've been a great guest. Thank you.
Love to do it.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
My exit's not working here. Well, listeners, thank you. We'll see you next Monday.